This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
During the holidays, we take flights to be with family. And during financial crises, we take flights to safety, or at least our money does. Certificates of deposit, savings accounts, money market funds. But what happens when too many of us go looking for a sure thing? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by the Poetry Foundation, in support of the American Public Media Poetry Initiative. More information online at poetryfoundation.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is December 22nd. It seems the entire investing community right now is looking for a safe place to park cash. People don't even care if they make any interest. They just want a guarantee that at least they're not going to lose their shirts. One popular parking spot? Money market funds. Even though one of the darlings of the field, the primary fund, broke the buck a couple of months ago, investors have been flooding into those funds. So many, in fact, that some fund companies are closing them to new depositors. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports on why that safety valve is being shut off.
When you make your money on debt, the higher the interest rate, the better. In the world of money market funds, the problem lies in the 20% or so that are invested entirely or almost entirely in U.S. Treasuries. Short-term government bonds are yielding almost nothing right now, so the cost of running a fund is more than the fees charged to investors. Milton Esrati is a senior economist at Lord Abbett & Company.
And so you're asking your depositors, effectively, the people who have their money in money funds, to get virtually no return. Or you subsidize it and you make no money on the money fund.
The pressure on funds may force some to shut down entirely, says Connie Bugbee of iMoneyNet.
I think we'll see that a small portion. But what we've seen over the years and we continue to see is some consolidation.
Milton Esrati says it's unlikely that any investor will actually lose money in a money market fund.
At the very least, they'd be breaking even or having a modest return.
He says it's more likely that investors will move their money elsewhere, perhaps to sometimes riskier funds that buy commercial paper, or maybe even back into the stock market.
The Federal Reserve is trying to induce people to invest in longer-term instruments and in equities. And so this is the first positive sign from what the Federal Reserve wants to accomplish.
In other words, bad news for short-term debt investors may be a nice Hanukkah gift for Ben Bernanke. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
A lot of Silicon Valley workers will be home for the holidays, even if they'd rather be working. Some tech companies are forcing furloughs on white-collar workers. It's taken a bit of time, but the recession has finally come to the tech sector. It's an industry that knows a thing or two about downsizing, having survived the dot-com boom of the 90s and the subsequent bust. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from the Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Tech companies have reined in everything from research and development budgets to public relations. Now it's time to cut employee costs. Tech analyst Carmi Levy with AR Communications says some firms have forced both manufacturing and white-collar workers to take time off.
A lot of companies that we deal with have told their employees to essentially come back after New Year's, that they are going to completely shut down.
Hewlett-Packard, Dell, and Cisco have all reportedly closed up shop for the holidays. Some firms told workers to count the forced days off as vacation time. The changes could be preemptive, a sign that tech firms learned their lessons from the tech bubble and want to cut back before staring down bankruptcy. A software developer who asked not to be identified for obvious reasons told me his company encouraged him to take vacation before the end of the year. But he's not complaining. He says he'd rather take time off than live through rounds of layoffs and salary cuts like he did in 2000.
Final round got staved off because instead of doing another round of layoffs, they did an across-the-board 15% pay cut. This certainly beats the pants off of either of those options.
And it beats some of the options other workers face, like four-day work weeks or reduced pay. But when it's that or the unemployment line, any arrangement can look like a good one. Executive coach Jason Zickerman's president of the Alternative Board. He says if you're one of the employees being asked to do more for less, you should be pleased.
The fact that they're thinking of creative ways to help keep your job while things turn around, I think is a very positive sign.
Zickerman thinks this is just the beginning. He says across-the-board sacrifices will continue in most sectors, including tech, into next year. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
As we've continued to track the fallout from this economic crisis, we've noticed one profession turning lemons into lemonade. Attorneys. Bankruptcy lawyers are doing lots of business, of course. So are securities specialists, especially those with clients tied to Bernie Madoff's alleged Ponzi scheme. Today we hear that labor lawyers are also on a bit of a roll. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
With massive job cuts sweeping the nation, law partner Paula Barron of Portland, Oregon, says more employers are being sued for discrimination. Laid-off employees have more time to sit around and stew with the economy in a slump, she says, and that's making them litigious. So companies should be careful.
You want to make sure that as you are doing the selections, you have very defensible ways of selecting the people who are going to be laid off.
Barron says employers should have legitimate business-based criteria, like cost, for putting people on the list. Then they should check that list twice.
If you find that you are laying off more minorities, more women, more older people, figure out why. You know, is it because they were the latest hired and you're doing this by last in, first out? That's a pretty defensible way to do it.
But when layoffs are performance-based, companies risk lawsuits if women or minorities disproportionately get the axe. Virginia Keeney is a plaintiff's lawyer in Pasadena, California.
If it's a woman, can she see a pattern of women being singled out for layoff while younger men or men are being retained?
Keeney says an employer could also be getting rid of squeaky wheels in the workplace under cover of layoffs.
You could have a wrongful termination where someone has been a whistleblower at work. They've raised complaints that the employer, for example, may be violating the law.
Employers might consider this advice from Paula Barron, offer a generous severance package. That'll encourage laid-off employees to sign an agreement not to sue you down the road. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, so much for the Santa Claus rally. Apparently it's stuck at the North Pole. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today's Wall Street Journal is reporting that one of the nation's largest mall owners got a temporary reprieve from lenders. General Growth Properties announced last week that it was putting some famous tourist areas, including Boston's Faneuil Hall and Baltimore's Harbor Place, up for sale. But the company was still at risk of bankruptcy. Now lenders have agreed to a forbearance, meaning they won't call in the loans until at least the end of January. That kind of grace period is very rare these days, even if it's in the best interest of the lender. Susan Wachter teaches real estate at the Wharton School of Business. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
So why aren't all lenders to commercial real estate developers either granting this forbearance or at least renegotiating credit agreements? Wouldn't that make them healthier?
Well, certainly would be if all would do it. It's a collective action problem. In this situation, as the economy continues to deteriorate, individual lenders can be fearful about whether if they're going to get paid back. In fact, the economy is getting worse. If they expend the time, lend more, in fact, they may find themselves deeper in debt.
So it really is a matter of I don't want to be out there standing alone.
Exactly. Banks themselves are concerned about their balance sheets. And at this time, as there's continued deterioration in their assets, for them, it makes sense to collect their debt.
How is this similar, if at all, to the issues that we're seeing on the residential side of the market, where, again, people are having a tough time being able to borrow any money?
Well, it differs in two ways. First of all, there is a lender out there on the residential side, and that's the federal government. In its entirety, there are almost no loans being made for residential mortgages except those backed by the federal government. And on the other side, there are, of course, lots of foreclosures, defaulting that's happening. And there is an argument on that side that foreclosures could be avoided if servicers were incentivized to make the loans. But this incentive problem is really quite different. Commercial lenders usually have the right incentives. It's just that the economy continues to worsen. And from a bottom line perspective, extending these debts may not make sense.
You know, one thing we continue to hear, at least on the residential side, is that banks are very hesitant to redo mortgages because they're afraid of investor lawsuits, the investors who bought all these mortgage-backed securities. Is that happening on the commercial side as well?
No, much less. Okay. That's really not the concern on the commercial side. That is absolutely the concern on the residential side. But in the commercial side, we also have these mortgage-backed securities, but normally, usually, typically, the servicer of the mortgage-backed security also owns a portion of the loan and is incentivized to operate for the sake of maximizing the net present value of the loan for all investors, including themselves.
Any indication of when the tide might turn on this? I mean, the Fed seems to have done everything it can in terms of bringing rates down, but there just is no cash being freed up for lending.
That's absolutely right, but I don't quite agree with you that the Fed has done everything. The Fed has stated that it will do everything, and that's not going to happen overnight. In addition, of course, we just simply have to see the real economy show signs of, if not bottoming out, at least that there will be massive stimulus so that a bottom can be seen. Both those factors have to be in place.
Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
China hammered another nail into the coffin of the decoupling theory today. You know, the idea that just because the U.S. sneezes, it doesn't mean China will catch a cold. Well, Beijing announced yet another interest rate cut today, just like the Fed did last week. The signs of the global economic crisis are showing up all over China. Factories are shutting. The unemployment rate is skyrocketing. China's experiment with the free market system began some 30 years ago in Shenzhen. Back then, it was an unknown fishing village. Today, it's another world. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Three decades ago, Shenzhen was a rural backwater. Just across the border, Hong Kong offered fancy British hotels and cream soda. All Shenzhen had was 30,000 farmers and fishermen.
Shenzhen was then a one-horse town.
That's Michael Morris, one of the first foreign businessmen allowed in.
There was a main street. There was a bit of stuff to the left and a bit of stuff to the right, and that was it.
Morris worked for Pepsi in the late 70s. That's when Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping opened up Shenzhen as a test tube to foreign investors. Morris built up a soda canning plant. His first challenge? Motivating workers.
The state didn't actually pay you very much, pretended to pay you, and in return, labor pretended to work.
In the early days, Morris says about half his workers would simply disappear at lunchtime. Sometimes they took the company vehicles with them.
And you'd say to these guys, what happened to the trucks? Oh, I had some coal to ship.
Clearly, there was no guarantee this free market stuff would fly. In fact, that's one reason China picked Shenzhen for this trial. It was insignificant. So if reform flopped, if a tree fell in Shenzhen, no one would hear it. Bill McCahill served in the U.S. Embassy in China in the 1970s.
There's an intrinsic Chinese fear of chaos. It goes from order to chaos, often in a split second, and people fear that that's what would happen.
Still, Deng Xiaoping stayed committed to the Shenzhen experiment. This song commemorates one of his high-profile visits there. It's called The Story of Spring, the idea that China's economy would blossom as it opened to the West. And eventually, big investors came. Pepsi was joined by the likes of McDonald's and Volkswagen. Bill McCahill.
The more the policy demonstrated that it was working and it was there to stay, foreign investors became much more positive about making larger scale investments.
So China replicated this model elsewhere. Other cities got Shenzhenified. Jiang Bo was an early official in the city.
If we were back in the Cultural Revolution in the 60s and people called me a capitalist traitor, I would deny it resolutely. If they called me that today, I would admit it resolutely.
Today, Shenzhen is China's richest city. The average person makes $10,000 a year. 30 years ago, he made $100. Liam Casey runs the supply chain consultancy PCH.
You have a very skilled labor force. You also have probably the best logistics system in the world. So I think that there's still quite a lot of opportunity here.
The old fishing village of Shenzhen is gone. The city is paved paradise, put up a train station. Migrant workers come and go here. The station is a tower of babel of Chinese dialects. And on the subway wall, an ad for Self magazine reads, 8 ways to tone up your calves. What's next for Shenzhen? Big challenges. Pollution is off the charts, as are labor costs. And since Shenzhen's an international city, it's particularly exposed to the global slowdown. Economist Cheng Jian-san is with the Chinese Academy for Social Sciences.
When our economy developed, it was trial and error. We didn't have much experience, and so we don't have much experience with downturns either.
Optimists think Shenzhen, and China in general, is flexible enough to handle whatever the free market brings. 30 years on, this test tube baby is not going back in the bottle. In Shenzhen, southern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, making tough choices in the face of a recession.
You know, just to go and apply for benefits, they embarrass you. And if you really need it, you don't care how much you're embarrassed. You've got to feed your kids.
But first, let's do the numbers. Nagging worries that the recession is eating away at corporate profits helped push stocks lower today. The Dow lost 59 points, 2/3%, to close at 8,519. The Nasdaq dropped 31 points, 2%, finished at 1532. The S&P fell 16 points, 1.8%, wrapping up trading at 871. It's looking more and more like the Grinch has stolen the hopes of holiday retailers. Some analysts are now worried it could be the worst shopping season in 40 years, and most retail stocks suffered from that news. Shares of Macy's fell nearly 12%. Stock in Sears dropped 6.5%. JCPenney was shortchanged by almost 6%. Bond prices fell, raising the yield on the 10-year T-note to 2.17%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. A couple economic indicators in the closely watched housing market are released. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes, while the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes. And in Mexico, Oaxacans celebrate Noche de Rabanos, or Night of the Radishes. Giant radishes are sculpted into animals and people. These figures are set in nativity scenes and scenes of local history. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdal. As we continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis, an update on the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. Today, a judge approved the sale of its asset management unit, Neuberger Berman. Price tag? $922 million. And who's buying? Neuberger Berman's employees. The Lehman bankruptcy in September is widely seen as a watershed moment. How could it be that a century-old Wall Street stalwart goes belly up? And you hear echoes of that question throughout this crisis. How did all this get so out of control? How did banks allow people with poor credit to get large mortgages? How on earth did we get to this point? According to commentator Amelia Tiaghi, it's time to regulate finances at least as strictly as we regulate toys.
Global megabanks are trading options and derivatives at lightning speed. And yet, we're still regulating consumer finance like it's 1699. Nearly all of our consumer safety laws are founded on the modern notion that citizens should be protected from dangerous products. No one can sell you an aspirin with a 1 in 6 chance of containing arsenic. You can't buy a riding lawnmower with a 1 in 6 chance of blowing up the minute you turn it on. But you can buy a mortgage that has a 1 in 6 chance of leading you into foreclosure and leaving you out on the street. And that's assuming you use the product exactly as designed with no changes in your income. Why the difference? Because the legal system treats financial products as contracts rather than products. The laws of consumer finance are basically the same as they were in the 1600s, built on the assumption that two equal parties are haggling away, coming to an agreement which the law should enforce. The law assumes that the average Joe is on the same footing as a trillion-dollar bank and can simply bargain over double-cycle billing or the arbitration clause. Of course, this is absurd. The solution is simple. It's time to give home mortgages, car loans, and other financial products the same safety provisions we afford a tube of lipstick. A financial product safety commission could review products to ensure that they work, without any hidden dangers or unreasonable tricks. Companies would be held to a set of reasonable standards designed for the modern era. Consumers would have more confidence in the financial products. In time, we would see a drop in foreclosures and bankruptcies and take a major step toward avoiding another global financial meltdown. Or we could keep regulating like it's 1699, and the next time your blood pressure goes up because you have a problem on your credit card, you can just send a messenger to your barber surgeon asking him to ride over in his horse and buggy to put some leeches on your arm.
Amelia Tiaghi is co-founder and chief operating officer of Business Talent Group. We want to hear your thoughts. Send them to marketplace.org. It's that time when many of us look back on the past 12 months and try to figure out how to take some of those lessons into the new year. And oh, how many, many lessons are available to all of us from the financial cataclysm that was 2008. Today and tomorrow, we're visiting with two American families to see how they're reflecting the new economic realities. First, we go to Orange Park, Florida, where a family with four kids was already struggling before the crisis hit. Now, with the country in a deepening recession, they're barely hanging on. Katie Ball has our report.
The Greenleys were a middle-class family living their version of the American dream in Waterbury, Connecticut.
My husband was the first person in his family to ever own a house. We refinished the wood floors. We had redone the kitchen.
Scott had a good job as a warehouse truck loader for a Stop and Shop supermarket. His wife, Beth, says they were doing well. In fact, the Greenleys even managed to buy a second house that they rented out for extra income.
Julia was born in December 2005, so that's really when it all hit the fan.
Their third child, Julia, was born 3 months premature. And while his newborn was still in the hospital, Scott was laid off from his job of 7 years.
And he got laid off with 400 other guys. So when they all went looking for jobs, there was very slim pickings.
In addition, Beth found out she was pregnant again. The Greenleys were sliding fast. They attempted to sell their houses before foreclosure, but there were no offers, no bites. They lost both homes and then headed down to Florida.
We figured we would move to a warmer climate in case we had to live in our tents.
She laughs, but she isn't joking. The family did manage to get into a rental house, and Scott got himself a new full-time job, but at a fraction of his old pay. And they still need financial assistance just to get by, but their request for food stamps was denied this month. Beth says people look at her differently now that she needs financial aid.
You know, just to go and apply for benefits, they embarrass you, and if you really need it, you don't care how much you're embarrassed. You've got to feed your kids.
What major changes in your lives have you made to keep your head above water?
In 2006, during the holiday season, I had to call all my family and friends and tell them that we couldn't exchange gifts.
Times are so tight that Beth can't even afford her blood pressure medication, and the family ditched the cable and other non-essential expenses. But Beth's still a smoker. She's trying to quit, but she says their financial stress makes it hard to kick it. And yeah, she does see the irony in that line of thinking.
Come here. Let's put this paper on.
Beth's a stay-at-home mom, and she thinks about getting an outside job, but she faces the same challenge a lot of parents experience.
I've been out of work for 9 years, so for me to go to work, I have to take something entry-level, and it wouldn't even pay for daycare for one of my girls, never mind two of them.
How much do they know about what's going on?
My 8-year-old, he's with me a lot, so there's been a few times where I try not to cry in front of him, but there's been a few times where I broke down. So he probably understands a little more emotionally than any of the other kids.
But he's still an 8-year-old, and Christmas is coming up.
Because he's been able to grasp some of our financial woes, he actually only asked for two things this year. And I think my mom and my dad are going to be able to pull it off.
Support from family and friends, well-worn toys, old cars in the drive. In a lot of ways, it looks like normal, everyday life. And it only hits home when you really think about what this family has lost. But still, how has it changed your relationship with your husband?
I think it's made it stronger. We know one another better. We respect one another more. You know, we've simplified, and we found our blessings in that.
Not very. He's in this mess somewhere.
From Orange Park, Florida, I'm Katie Ball for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, there's one more reason to be thankful for those government rebate checks earlier this year, especially if you haven't given Uncle Sam his due. The IRS says collections from audits and other reviews fell this year because the agency was so busy making sure we all got our stimulus checks. Collections dropped by 4.7% to just over $56 billion. Better luck next year, taxman. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 59 points, 2/3%. The Nasdaq fell 31 points, 2%. And the S&P 500 dropped 16 points, 1.8%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, a down economy doesn't always touch those at the top.
It's really hard when you're in that pool of people to have more than they do, because there is this feeling that we're not going through the same thing that the country is going through.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.